following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
So what do you do when you're trying to follow God's leadership in your life and you run into obstacles and opponents and opposition? I mean, sometimes we get this false idea that just because we're following Jesus, everything's going to run smoothly. Oh, happy day! Yeah. I hate to bust your bubble, but the truth is, nothing can be further from the truth. I mean, Jesus himself said, in this world you will have tribulation. But then he went on to say, take courage. I have overcome the world. Sometimes we encounter trouble just because we live in a fallen, corrupt world where pain and suffering are baked in. Okay? It's part of living on planet Earth. Other times, God uses the obstacles and the opposition we encounter to grow our faith, to deepen our trust in him. Sometimes he uses those things to test our maturity, to see where we are in that process of sanctification. And then other times, he allows us to face opposition simply to display his own power and grace as he carries us through those challenges. But mark my words, if you set out to follow Jesus, you will face obstacles and opposition. Sometimes you'll even face obstacles and opposition because you're seeking to follow Jesus. Just last week, we started looking at the story of the Battle of Jericho in the book of Joshua, chapter 6. And we wanted to see how that episode can teach us about how to handle obstacles and opposition. You'll remember about 3,400 years ago, Joshua and the people of Israel were seeking to follow God's instructions to conquer the land of Canaan and claim it as their own. They knew that would not be an easy task because there were all kinds of obstacles and opposition in that land. Canaan was full of fierce warriors who lived in great walled cities. And the first of those cities that Israel encountered was the city of Jericho. And as we looked at the beginning of that story there in chapter 6, verse 1, to recap really quickly what we learned last week, we learned how rejecting God is a serious matter. As verse 1 tells us, Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. Jericho not only was shut up against Israel's army, but also Israel's God. And we talked about how the inhabitants of Jericho had heard the stories of how God had delivered the people of Israel time and time again. But instead of turning to that one true God, the people of Jericho had rejected him. They shut up both their gates and their hearts against him. And therefore, their fate was on their own heads. And we drew from that and, tracing that thought out through the rest of Scripture, how the more tightly we shut our own hearts up against God, the more likely he is just to give us what we want by shutting us out of his presence. See, if we reject God long enough, eventually he's going to honor our wishes. And since our souls were designed to live in relationship to him, being separated from him for all eternity is a fate worse than death. Now that we've established that, we can move on to see what else we can learn from this story of the Battle of Jericho. And here's the big one right here. God removes obstacles on behalf of the obedient. In verse 2, God assures Joshua of success. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I've given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors." Did you catch that? Did you see anything unusual about that? Here they are facing off against this great walled city full of powerful warriors. And God says, look, I've already given it to you. God spoke about what was to come as if it had already happened. From God's perspective, that's how sure it was. And this statement also reveals the real secret of Joshua's success. It wasn't Joshua's abilities as a general, although he's considered one of history's most understated generals. It wasn't some clever strategy, as we're going to see in just a moment. It was not a set of favorable conditions. You know, all they didn't just have good luck. All the things didn't just line up at just the right time. No, the secret of Joshua's success was that God himself was working through Joshua and the people of Israel to carry out his own plan. And as part of that plan, God gave Joshua a most unusual strategy. Verse 3, this is God speaking to Joshua. He says, "You shall march around the city, all the men of war, circling the city once. You'll do it for 6 days. Also, 7 priests will carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And on the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times. And the priests will blow the trumpets. And it shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout. And the walls of the city will fall down flat. And the people will go up, every man straight ahead." Now, in the ancient world, there were basically 2 ways to take a walled city, typically. One, you try to break down the walls through a direct assault. That's the hard way. The second way was to besiege the city, to surround it and starve out the inhabitants. That took longer, but was less wear and tear on your own people. God's telling Joshua, here's the plan. He doesn't tell him to do either one of those things. He says, "Joshua, here's what you're going to do. Okay, first of all, you're going to line up the ark and the priest." Okay, now the ark was this box that God had asked Moses to make that represented God's presence. It was normally kept in the innermost compartment of what was called the tabernacle, which was the sanctuary where Israel would come to worship and offer their sacrifices to God. And it represented where heaven touched earth. This box, it represented God's own presence. So as they carry this out, it's like God's going with their army. He says, you take the priest, you take the ark, you march around the army. The whole army's going to follow that and march around the walls of Jericho 1 time. Okay? Can you imagine what that was like for the men guarding those walls from inside Jericho? Here comes this massive army, this parade that comes. You know, they're coming in the distance. There's probably a huge cloud of dust. And they're like, "Here they come, guys, get ready." And this army comes, and instead of assaulting the walls, they just march around the perimeter of the city and all the way around, and then they go back to camp. Whoa, what was that about? Next day, here they come again. This has got to be it, guys, get ready. And they come and they march around the city again, all the way around, and then they go back to camp. Probably about day 4, these guys on the walls are starting to set their watches by the Israelites. We're not told this in the text, but if you know human nature, you can understand this. They're probably saying, "Oh, here they come again, guys." And they're probably hurling down insults. They're probably, you know, maybe throwing stuff from the walls. They're saying, "Oh, here they come again. These guys, they don't have the guts to come against our city. They're just going to march around like crazy." And by day 6, they're thinking, that's all these guys can do is parade. Then comes day 7, and they march around the city 7 times. And on the 7th day, after the 7th circuit, when a special signal was given by that ram's horn, all the Israelites would turn to face the walls and shout. And God said, "The walls will come down." And the Israelite soldiers would be able to attack the city from all sides. Now, normally when you assaulted the walls, you were lucky if you broke the walls in one place. You'd find a weak spot, you'd take your battering rams, you'd try to go through there, and then the defenders would still have a time trying to defend the city because all your people have to go through one spot. But in this case, the walls fell in from every point. The Israelites are surrounding the city. They get to come in from every direction and overwhelm the defenders all at once. It's an amazing strategy. And some of the things we can see in this strategy is that it would accomplish are this. One, it would rest on the faith of Joshua and the people of Israel. This is a pretty big ask coming from God. God says, "I'm not going to have you do what you normally think you ought to do. You're going to have to trust me. If you do it the way I tell you, then this is what's going to happen." And how many times do we sense God leading us in direction and we say, "Yeah, but that's not what the experts say"? Sometimes it doesn't matter what the experts say. Now, God gives us experts for a reason, but sometimes God has a better idea. And we need to learn to trust God and follow him and not look at the walls, not look at the defenders, not listen to the insults, not listen to the taunts. We just need to trust God. And the second thing is we need to obey God, because this strategy rested on the obedience of the Israelites. God says, I'm going to give you the city, but they had a part to play, didn't they? Sometimes we'd rather just sit back on our laurels and let God do all the work. But God says, no, you got a part in this. I'm going to do it for you, but you still got to make a contribution. Here's how you do it. And so we have to obey. And thirdly, God's strategy for taking Jericho would render glory to God. Because in the end, who made those walls fall down? It was God's power. It was God's strategy. It wasn't Joshua's. Now, some people try to offer a naturalistic explanation for Joshua's strategy based on science. Some of you may be familiar with this. That you can find this story all over the place, but I got it from LiveScience.com. Back in April of 1831, there was a brigade of British soldiers who were marching over the Broughton Suspension Bridge in England. Okay? And all of a sudden, the bridge collapsed, tossing several of the soldiers into the river. And investigators determined that the rhythmic marching of the soldiers set up a vibration that caused that bridge to collapse. It's a phenomenon called mechanical resonance. And so whether that's true or not, ever since, British soldiers have been instructed. And this may be true in other armies, but I know it's true in the British Army. British soldiers have been instructed when they come to a bridge, they have to intentionally break step as they go across that bridge because they don't want to ever see something like that happen again. And some people say, well, that's what happened to Jericho. That all that marching and blowing and shouting, that caused those walls just to vibrate and fall in. Well, listen, even if, and I'm not saying it is, but even if that is the explanation, if there's some scientific reason all this happened, that doesn't write God's power out of the story. Far from it. For one thing, how did the Israelites know to do that? Huh? Because God told them to. Right? And if it were that easy to defeat a walled city, wouldn't everybody do it that way? Isn't it amazing it happened at just the right time, at just the right spot, to bring about the result God told them to expect? So some lessons that we can draw out of this episode. No matter what the secondary cause is, the primary cause was God, and we can learn the same lessons. One, trust in God's plan, even when it doesn't make sense. Two, obey God's instructions. And three, give God all the credit for the results. Now, it's important for us to give God the credit because, as the next section shows us, God protects his prerogatives. God gives them some very dreadful instructions about what to do once they came into those walls. According to verse 17, the city shall be under the ban. It and all in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all those who are with her in the house shall live because she hid the messengers whom we sent. God was reserving the spoils of this city for himself. Normally in an ancient battle, when the walls were breached and the enemy soldiers rushed in, the generals would give their men free rein to steal whatever they could get their hands on. That's how you kept soldiers happy. God told Joshua and the Israelites, you don't lay a finger on anything for yourself. And that's what it means, the expression under the ban. It means God is reserving that city for himself. The actual Hebrew term is cherem, which means to set apart for the Lord. Now, the ban required the Israelites to slay every living thing in the city and to deposit all the treasure in the treasury at the tabernacle, that central sanctuary. Think of this as similar to how the Israelites had been instructed to make offerings to God at the tabernacle. They were to slay an animal and then burn the animal's carcass on the altar, right? Well, in a way, everything and everyone in Jericho was being claimed by God as an offering. And a lot of modern people look at that, and they freak out. I mean, that's horrible, isn't it? I mean, our modern sensibilities, we look at something like that, and we say, how can a loving, compassionate God sanction such bloodshed? Or how can a holy God command genocide here? And to be honest, those are fair questions, okay? We need to deal with those. But the thing we need to keep in mind is the context here, okay? The fact is, God was declaring divine judgment against the city of Jericho. And God's judgment against Jericho was based on two factors. One, the total depravity of the Canaanites. And I'm not using that term exclusively like the Calvinists do, basically just saying the Canaanites of this period were not very nice people. I mean, these people were guilty of gross idolatry, immorality, and injustice. Among their many sins was a toleration of child sacrifice or temple prostitution. Women and sometimes even men being forced into prostitution as a religious practice to encourage fertility. I'm surely a man had to come up with that kind of religion. And one thing we don't often realize when we look at this and say, man, that is hardcore. That is horrible. We don't always understand God had already extended incredible mercy towards these Canaanites. But that mercy had finally run out. 500 years before, God had promised Abraham. Abraham was the original Hebrew. And God had brought Abraham to the land of Canaan. He said, Abraham, one of these days, I'm going to give this land to your descendants. Okay, well, God, why don't you just go ahead and do it now? You know, why do we have to wait for my descendants? And God gives him a very good reason. In Genesis 15, 16, he says he wouldn't give the land over in Abraham's lifetime because, quote, the wrongdoing of the Amorite is not yet complete. Now, the Amorites were one of the peoples that were living in Canaan. They kind of stand in for all the Canaanites in this verse. But basically, God tells Abraham, Abraham, one day I'm going to give this to your people, but not yet, because there's still a chance to maybe save some of these Canaanites. There's still a chance some of them may see the light and repent and turn to me. We haven't yet reached a place where they are beyond hope. God is a God of compassion and mercy. But there's a point where even God will give us over to our own perversity and rebelliousness. And at this point, the Canaanites had reached that level. And when God gives up hope on you, you've really crossed the line. Because God's patience is to 1,000 generations, according to Scripture. Now, before we look too far down our noses at some of these Canaanites and say, man, those are really bad people, and thank God I'm not them, consider this. If God would wipe out the Canaanites for sacrificing their own children at an idol's altar, what's he going to do to a nation where the blood of 60 million unborn babies cries out to him? And we can name other sins. When President Lincoln, at his second inauguration, I mean, Lincoln is a kind of an enigma of a president. He was a very religious man, but he wasn't really attached with any particular denomination. But he said in his second inaugural address that he believed that all the lives lost during the Civil War were God's judgment against America for the sin of slavery. God doesn't play around. God takes sin seriously, and so should we. That's the first reason that God gave the Israelites to wipe out these Canaanites in Jericho. The second reason, because the temptation the Canaanite culture would represent to God's people. Even before the Israelites had arrived in Canaan, God had warned them against making any kind of treaty with the Canaanites. In Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 7, listen to this, what he says. When the Lord, this is Moses speaking to the people of Israel, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you're entering to take possession of it, and he drives away many nations from before you, and then he lists all these different nations that made up Canaan. He says, seven nations greater and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God turns them over to you and you defeat them, you shall utterly destroy them. You'll not make a covenant with them or be gracious to them. Furthermore, you'll not intermarry with them, and you will not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me, and they'll serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he'll quickly destroy you. But this is what you shall do. You'll tear down their altars, smash their memorial stones, cut down their asherim to pieces. Those were poles that were used to worship the goddess Asherah. You'll burn their carved images in the fire, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his personal possession out of all the people who are on the face of the earth. And at least five times that I know of in the Mosaic Law, God warned the Israelites against tolerating the Canaanites and said, if you do, that will lead to your own downfall. And history would demonstrate the wisdom of that injunction. Because what happened? Well, the Israelites did fail to eradicate all the Canaanite culture from the land. And later Israelites would seek to blend that Canaanite culture with their own, leading them into the very same idolatry, immorality, and injustice that characterized the Canaanites. And so God would have to judge his own people. You tell me, if you're standing up here on a ledge, is it easier for you to pull somebody up to your level or for them to pull you down to theirs? It's easier for them to pull you down because they got gravity on their side. And it kind of works the same way with sin and temptation. As Paul warns us in 1 Corinthians 15:33, don't be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. There's some important lessons we can learn from this. One, God takes holiness seriously, deadly seriously. God takes his own holiness seriously, and he takes seriously the holiness of those who claim to belong to him. So we have to be very, very careful about the influences we allow into our lives. At the same time, our calling, and hear me here, our calling is not to call out the ungodliness of other people, but it's to pursue godliness in our own lives. Deal with the log in your own life before you deal with a speck in somebody else's. Because when you look around and you see lost people doing ungodly things, they're just doing what lost people do. They don't know any better. And don't forget, you were one of them at one point. And so God, in his grace, reached down and plucked you out and transformed your life. If you spend all your time saying, well, look at all those terrible people, you're doing this wrong, okay? Instead, our focus should be, my God, thank you for having mercy on this sinner. The Apostle Paul gave instructions to the church at Corinth, which are very instructive here. Now, the church at Corinth found itself surrounded by one of the most immoral and permissive cultures the world has ever known. Corinth has often been called the New Orleans of the Mediterranean. Whatever your perverse taste was, you could probably find it in Corinth displayed out on a street corner and advertised. Prostitution, all kinds of sexual immorality, all kinds of other vices. To borrow a phrase, a more wretched hive of scum and villainy has never been seen. Okay? And Paul tells this church in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 through 13. He says, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. But listen to how he defines that. Okay? He says, I didn't mean all the sexually immoral people of the world or the greedy and swindlers or idolaters. In other words, when I told you don't hang out with bad people, I didn't mean bad people out there, because then you'd have to leave planet Earth. Because guess what? Wherever you go, you're always going to be surrounded with people who don't know the Lord and don't recognize his commands. He goes on to say, but actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is sexually immoral or a greedy person or an idolater or is verbally abusive. There goes about half the pastors on social media. Or habitually drunk or a swindler. Don't even eat with such a person. So it wasn't the people out there Paul was worried about when he wrote to Corinth. It was the people in here. He says, what business of mine is it to judge outsiders? Do you not judge those who are within the church? For those who are outside, God judges. Remove the evil person from among yourselves. We need to police ourselves. Our job's not to police the world. We need to focus on being the people of God who represent God to the rest of the world. When my kids were growing up, you may think this is a little weird, but when my kids were growing up, we did not let them watch SpongeBob SquarePants. And you say, what's wrong with that? Well, the reason is because my wife had some problems with the way the characters on that show treated each other. Now, my wife has a bachelor's degree in early childhood education. She has 18 years of experience in an actual classroom, another 17 years of additional experience working with preschoolers. So when it comes to what's best for small children, I tend to defer to my wife's expertise, okay? That, and I have this natural skepticism against jumping on bandwagons. So we didn't let our kids watch SpongeBob SquarePants. Of course, they would go to the grandparents' house, and guess what they would watch? Oh, well. But they would always complain, why can't we watch SpongeBob? All of our friends watch SpongeBob. And I would say, I'm not your friend's father. This is how we do it in our house. And that's all we can control, is what's in our house. Folks, as believers, we are part of God's household. So we are expected to reflect God's character and God's values, to the rest of the world. Doesn't matter what the rest of the world's doing, okay? We need to worry about us and hold one another accountable with gentleness and grace and compassion. And then we can interact with people outside all we need to, okay? We just don't let them influence how we see God and the choices we make. Instead, we beg and plead with them to come and see God as He is. Another lesson we learned, God's judgment against sin is real. So we need to be ruthless about rooting out sin in our own lives. We also need to be diligent with pleading with our neighbors to repent and return to God. Not judging them, not condemning them, but pleading with them to consider there could be a better way. Something else we learn in this passage is God offers rescue to those who respond in faith. And this goes, if you're really worried, still worried about God's commands to Israel to wipe out the city of Jericho, just consider this. Verse 22, Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, "Go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there as you have sworn to her." So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and mother and her brothers and all she had, and brought them out, all of her relatives, and placed them outside the camp of Israel. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold, the articles of bronze and iron, they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all that she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day. For she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Now, we pointed out when we looked at Rahab's story back in Joshua chapter 2. Rahab lived a life most people would consider scandalous. No argument there. Okay, this was a lady with a past. However, when Rahab heard about Israel's God, she didn't shut up her heart like all of her neighbors did. Instead, she chose to cast her lot with Him. She recognized Him as the one true God. We saw that in chapter 2. She demonstrated her faith in action by helping the Israelites conquer the city. She sheltered the spies. She helped them escape. She followed their instructions to put a cord out of her window so they would know where she lived. She gathered all of her family together under that protection by faith. See, the issue is not where you start out in life. It's where you end up. And God stands ready to receive anyone who repents and responds to Him in faith. Romans 10, verses 9 and 10 says, "If you will confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved." Doesn't say you have to have a perfectly clean record. Doesn't say you have to be without sin. It says, if you will confess Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved. We could probably think of fewer individuals as wicked as the captain of a slave ship. I told you, God sent me a signal. Here it is. Because I had no idea what Michael was going to sing this morning. Can you think of anybody who'd be more wretched than the captain of a slave ship? Somebody who would traffic other human beings, stack them into the hold of a ship like cordwood, barely enough room to move, no room for facilities to take care of natural functions. Somebody got sick, oh well, if they died, just toss them overboard. John Newton was a man like that. And yet, John Newton heard the good news about Jesus. And he repented and he turned to God in faith. And not only did God accept this wretched slave captain, he totally changed his life. And those stirring words that we heard Michael sing while ago, those were penned by John Newton, the former slave captain. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. I was blind, but now I see. Anybody who will turn to God, doesn't matter where you started, if you'll come and cast yourself on His mercy and His grace, He will receive you. And as I told you, the biblical writers, they make no apologies whatsoever for Rahab's background, but you notice they treat her with honor because she turned to God in faith. It's not where you start, it's where you end up. And God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Story ends in verse 26. Then Joshua made them take an oath at the time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation. With the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. After conquering the city of Jericho, Joshua proclaimed a curse to prevent anybody from rebuilding it. That's how wretched a place it was. And according to 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 34, Joshua's curse played out pretty much exactly as he predicted. There was a few hundred years later, after this battle, there's a man named Hiel from Bethel. And he set out to rebuild Jericho. It was pretty amazing. Nobody tried to rebuild it in the meantime, right? But he says, I'm going to rebuild Jericho. So he laid out the foundations. And the year he laid out the foundations, and the scripture tells us his firstborn son died. And the day he completed the project and put the gates in the walls, his youngest son died. Just as Joshua had predicted. Now, eventually, the site of ancient Jericho was abandoned. I've been there. I've seen the ruins. The modern city is built about 10 miles south. Eventually, they gave up and said, this place, there's something about this place that's just not kosher. But here's the thing. That's just kind of a side note. But here's the important thing I wanted you to understand. Because Joshua trusted God and followed his instructions, God honored Joshua with success. So we read in 1 Peter 5, verse 6, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God so that he may exalt you at the proper time. I've tried to live those verses. I don't know how many times I've been in situations where I said, you know, that's not fair. When you're in ministry and you start to say, well, I'm not getting the recognition I deserve, that's kind of a dangerous thing. You need to, red flags ought to go up. But I've learned that if I will just trust God and keep doing what he's called me to do, sooner or later, at just the right time, he'll take care of me. And he'll take care of you as well. If you will set out to trust him and to obey what he's given you to do. Church, the rest of the world may say Christianity's dying. People don't want to go to church anymore. But you know what? God says the gates of hell will not stand against my church. The enemy has a vested interest in trying to scare us into doing nothing. He will spare no expense to divide us, to discourage us, to defeat us, or to even destroy us if he could. But greater is he who is in us than he that is in the world. And God's given this church a purpose in this community. It is better to have the approval of God than the applause of men. Charles Simeon was an English pastor in the 18th century. In 1783, he was appointed pastor of Holy Trinity Church in Cambridge, kind of a prestigious post. Except many members of that church did not really want him to be their pastor. They actually had wanted somebody else and were a little resentful that Simeon had been called in this other guy's place. One of the things they didn't appreciate about Simeon was he was all about evangelism and outreach and missions. And some of them didn't want anything to do with that. So several of the rich members would start skipping services. But get this, you know, everybody had their own pews back then. They paid for their pews. They would lock up their pews so nobody else could sit there. Yeah, almost sounds like a Baptist church, doesn't it? But they would block their pew boxes so nobody else could sit there. Then they wouldn't show up. So all these people who came to hear Simeon preach would end up either standing or sitting in the aisles. When people saw him on the street, they would hurl insults at him. If they would say stuff to his face, you can only imagine what they're saying behind his back, right? They made his life miserable. But Simeon kept plugging away faithfully. On one occasion, he wrote this. In this state of things, I saw no remedy but faith and patience. It was painful indeed to see the church, with the exception of the aisles, almost forsaken. But I thought that if God would only give a double blessing to the congregation that did attend, there would be, on the whole, be as much good done as if the congregation were doubled and the blessing limited to only half that amount. This comforted me many, many times. Without such a reflection, I should have sunk beneath my burden. God honored Simeon's faithfulness. And eventually, that church did begin to grow. It did begin to reach people. And Simeon's influence not only spread in that church, in that community, it spread all across England, and through his support of missions, spread throughout the world. See, when you set out to follow Jesus, don't be surprised when you run into obstacles. Don't be surprised when you run into opposition. Like I said, the enemy's got a vested interest in keeping you from making an advance. But remember, we serve a God who moves mountains. We serve a God who parts waters, and we serve a God who specializes in tearing down the walls. So have faith and keep moving forward.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.